This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today my friend Lydia Walker. Lydia is an assistant professor and the Myers Chair in Global Military History at The Ohio State University, and also the author of States in Waiting, a Counter-Narrative of Global Decolonization. And we're continuing our discussion of this book. So Lydia, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks a lot, Danny and Derek. Much appreciate the opportunity to speak at such length. Didn't realize
incredible length. It never ends.
Everybody says that. They really appreciate the multiple times that they have to come on the show.
No, they love it. They love it so much. So Lydia, I think we're going to talk today about this place called Katanga. But before we do, why don't we wrap up a little bit talking about the World Peace Brigade and maybe even the larger firmament of which the World Peace Brigade was a part to get us into this question of Katanga.
Thanks, Danny. So I think we closed sort of our first set of conversations with this concept of non-state actor and its relationship to the state, and also why sort of there's so much scholarship right now on so-called non-state actors. And I think I might have discussed how it's really interesting when we talk about non-state actors. It's a term that can include terrorist organizations, it can include Amnesty International, it can include a whole host of individuals and organizations. The World Peace Brigade is a non-governmental advocacy organization. It is founded by international pacifists, or since some of them are not outright pacifists, they're in favor of nonviolent direct action. And the three leaders are A.J. Musty in the United States, Reverend Michael Scott, based in the UK, and Jayaprakash Narayan, based in India. But they are very much sort of what you might want to think of as liberal internationalist do-gooders. They're connected to state power, but also who's funding their organizations. So Scott's Africa Bureau, one of his main backers is Ronald Prain of the Rhodesian Selection Trust mining company. The majority shareholder of the Rhodesian Selection Trust is the American Metal Climax mining company, run by the Hochschild brothers. Adam Hochschild is a descendant. So this is a long way of saying that people like the World Peace Brigade are actually connected to corporate interests, not necessarily as stooges, but that non-state actors is a big, broad, capacious category that includes corporations. And this becomes really important in sub-Saharan Africa, in regions that have significant natural resources. And the kind of epicenter of this activity is in Katanga in southeastern Congo, which attempts to secede in the summer of 1960. And the UN ends up sending in a military intervention to prevent Katanga from seceding. This is, the UN doesn't do much until Lumumba, Patrice Lumumba, the democratically elected leader of Congo Leopoldville, is assassinated. That's also a kind of controversial history we can get at, or you can read Ludo De Wit's book on it. But this is all to say that Katanga is really the center of gravity during this period of time. And it's not just about the UN intervention, it's and the mining interests. The main multinational corporation in Katanga is Union Minière, the Belgian mining multinational, and they back Moïse Tshombe's regime in Katanga. So it's not just the presence of the United Nations and the presence of mines, it's also the prospect of revising post-colonial borders at the moment of independence. The United Nations is kind of petrified about this. Ralph Bunche talks about, like, you know, the balkanization that might happen if every, you know, if these post-colonial states fracture. And so Katanga is very much on people's minds when thinking about state formation sort of all over the decolonizing world.
Thanks, Lydia. So one of the important things that you talk about is Kennedy, the John F. Kennedy administration and decolonization, and how Katanga related to or did not relate to Kennedy's approach. So maybe you could talk a little bit about JFK, his team, how the U.S. was thinking about decolonization, and where Katanga fit into that.
Thanks. Yeah, this is where Kennedy, and not just Kennedy the person, but John F. Kennedy, the team that surrounded him, fits in here is really interesting. First, it's important to realize that the U.S. doesn't have an African Affairs office at the State Department until 1958. The U.S. really knows nothing about what's going on the African continent, except for intelligence that's shared with from basically Britain and France and imperial allies. And when JFK is positioning himself for a run for national office, one of the things he does is he wants to, I mean, I believe that he also is sincerely interested in issues of national self-determination, but he also is wanting to present a contrast with the Eisenhower administration on issues of decolonization. And so he, you know, there's a famous speech on Algeria and support of the Algerian revolution. And that really does push Algerian independence forwards. Matthew Connelly's written a book on this. And so that's fairly well known. But at issue with there being so little information in the United States about what's going on in the African continent, this really empowers advocates, non-state actors, people who are part of the World Peace Brigade community, not necessarily the brigade specifically, but are part of the sort of social circle and connected to them, who have recent experience on the African continent to be brought in to the Kennedy team as advisors on African decolonization questions. I focus in States in Waiting and also a chapter I wrote in an edited volume on a woman named Winifred Armstrong, who is first works for the Kennedy team, always in an unofficial capacity, and then ends up working for Amex Mining, American Metal Climax Mining Company, for the same reasons, because of her connections and knowledge to what's going on in the African continent. She goes to, I'll say Africa, because she actually flies a round trip to Cape Town and spends 2 years getting on and off the plane regularly, because that's what you used to be able to do with a round trip air ticket. And she spends 2 years on the African continent, 1956 to 1958. When she returns, she knows, or 57 to 59. It's in the correct dates are in the book.
Don't worry. People could look at the book.
but she's there for Ghana's independence festivities. She's becoming friends with African nationalist leaders. And so when she returns to the States, she knows more about what's going on. And she's not unique. The Angolanist John Markham is part of this circle, also advises the Kennedy team. And so JFK and the people around him almost become a portal or a way that anti-colonial nationalists can access American politics. And I should mention that this is before JFK is president. After he's president, it becomes all much more formalized and much harder to access. But while he's senator, while he's running for president, and then also in those the months between being elected and becoming president, is when in some ways his team is kind of most permeable to anti-colonial nationalist leaders. And I mean, 1960, 17 countries become independent. The summer of 1960, it seems like a country's becoming independent every week. So that year, which is a presidential election year, is sort of really important in terms of this kind of rapid political change.
And there's also this UN, correct me if I'm wrong, but this UN Declaration on Independence in 1960 as well, right? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so it's the UN Declaration on the Granting of Independence, which I find very interesting. It's not the UN Declaration on Independence, it's on the Granting of Independence, which sort of shows that it's how seriously the United Nations is taking its position as this kind of arbiter of international recognition. And this is also 1960, and this really establishes national self-determination as an international norm. The committee that pushes this forward is under Indian chairmanship, which matters for how the Nehru government is positioning itself internationally on being, at least rhetorically, very supportive of anti-colonial nationalist liberation. And the U.S. and the Soviet Union both support it. The U.S. switches from not supporting it to supporting it. I believe the declaration is in December. So it's, Kennedy's almost president.
So how does the Cold War fit into all of this? Because this is the moment, at least in the Americanist historiography, literally, I think 59-60 is pointed to as the moment when the Cold War shifts from Europe to the quote-unquote third world. So how does Kennedy coming into office, the UN declaration, the fact of all these new nationalisms fit into the larger bipolar conflict, which at least, again, according to an Americanist perspective, is now shifting to new areas of the world? And how does this claims making of self-determination and anti-colonialism fit into that larger framework? And just to maybe put a fine point on it, I think this is a kind of a debate that got going in the early 2010s, and it's kind of fizzled out. I don't know why. I think that's probably more an artifact of the field dying than anything. But like, what is the best way to understand the second half of the 20th century? Is it Cold War or is it decolonization? Which one does one privilege? In actuality, it's both. But could you maybe talk a little bit about that question in the Cold War in general and how that fits into your story?
Yeah, so the analytic I use for the Cold War is I call it the Cold War trap, because the Cold War matters tremendously in how it sort of shapes the horizon of political possibility for many nationalist claimants and also new leaders of post-colonial states. But they themselves don't actually care about the Cold War really at all. So it's but it becomes very important for what leaders get empowered, get international backing. And a lot of it, especially in the early 60s, is coming from the United States. The aid that Lumumba gets from the Soviet Union is like a couple trucks. It's not actually significant. But the threat of Lumumba being communist is incredibly significant for who the U.S. filtering its power through the United Nations ends up sort of supporting in Congo. And I mean, I have a chapter in the book on Southwest Africa, Namibia, and their claims making strategy. And one of the sort of supreme ironies is SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, which becomes the dominant Namibian nationalist movement and is now the ruling political party of independent Namibia since 1990. They're actually backed by the First World in the early 1960s. And that's what really kind of empowers them to sort of get dominance of the Namibian nationalist movement. There's a lot of these negotiations happen in secret. But if anybody listening knows much about the Namibian nationalist movement, in some ways this might be a surprise. Because by the later 1960s, SWAPO's receiving aid from Cuba, from China, and has really kind of embraced Marxist-Leninist rhetoric and also alliance politics. I want to say one last thing, and that is about a distinction I use in the book between liberalist and liberationist. I got this from a play that Connor Cruz O'Brien, who was the UN sort of special advisor for Katanga, a controversial Irish politician and intellectual writer, very charismatic and a excellent writer, but ends up getting pushed out of his UN position because he's not perceived as supportive of enough of American interests. He's also a friend of the World Peace Brigade, of the Brigade community. There's a period of time where they want him actually to be a peace negotiator in Nagaland in Northeast India. He doesn't end up going. But this is a long way of saying Connor Cruz O'Brien, who you may well know in many other contexts, he just keeps turning up. So he deals with Katanga, specifically here, he writes a play called Murderous Angels on the Congo Crisis. And he has a distinction between liberationists and liberalists. Liberalists are people like Dag Hammarskjöld, the United Nations, also the Kennedy administration. And I also put the World Peace Brigade community, not just the brigade itself, but the wider intellectual circles in which it's plugged in, into that group. They want peaceful, because if it's peaceful, first of all, you know, it's better in all sorts of ways, but it also means how do I put this better? Peace also means peaceful mining. Peace isn't just a peace for its own sake. It's also what allows for the maintenance of global capitalist networks. So liberalists being in favor of peaceful regime change is also being in favor of regimes that don't nationalize resources or industries, don't kick out minority groups, and also end up being democratic. Liberationists, which Connor Cruz O'Brien refers to, he has Lumumba being the emblematic figure, one could talk about Fanon here and justified violence for regime change. And how that ends up aligning with the Second World in the Cold War is a very different sort of sphere of political action. Now, all of these are kind of what one might would say is center to left at various different points on the spectrum. But I think that the distinction that Cruz O'Brien makes between liberalists, which is not the same thing as liberals, and liberationists, is useful in thinking about the Cold War, as well as this, you know, the kind of relationship between ideological and material interests during this rapid period of regime change.
And kind of gesturing or emergent from that is this question of borders, which you gesture toward, which is why do most of these post-colonial states seem to fit, broadly speaking, within the colonial boundaries, which is something that I had never really thought about. But maybe you could talk about that issue a little bit.
Well, even countries that are completely opposed to each other in all sorts of ways can agree to not to recognize each other's separatist movements because no one wants their borders revised. Katanga is another phrase Connor Cruz O'Brien has about Katanga. He says it's when the winds of change start to veer. It's in some ways when the promise of decolonization gets tarnished. When the idea that national liberation can be universal and that it can be peaceful, it is very clear that that's not necessarily possible. And it's why the chapter I have on Katanga is called The Specter of Katanga, because it's about the shadow that, you know, that of what could happen to decolonization is happening to decolonization. So that's one aspect. And I mean, I spent like a week with the Assam Tribune, the sort of major newspaper in Assam in Northeast India. And one of the things I tracked was how much reporting on Congo is happening there, the UN intervention. It's like on front page news practically every day in like Northeast India. And I'm like, wait, this isn't in the 60s. I'm like, wait, why? And then I'm like, well, of course, Assam is full of secessionist movements. They're really interested in one that has a UN intervention in which Indian soldiers are deployed for the United Nations. This is actually of global significance in how other countries are going to deal with movements that are attempting to revise their borders. I mean, there are some that do, Bangladesh, but it's actually somewhat surprising how few nationalist movements actually, and of course, partition in South Asia. That is a decolonization that explicitly revises colonial borders, but they are few and far between. And that's because new post-colonial states themselves don't want it to happen.
So you gestured toward this already, which is this chapter on Namibia. And if I recall correctly, you use that to really illuminate this issue of capitalism, decolonization, and capital and claims making. So could you maybe talk a little bit about, first, broadly speaking, from a general perspective, I mean, how does capitalism shape things? But how does capitalism, or at least business interests, capitalism is reflected through particular extractive raw material interests, shape things? And then it might even be worthwhile for people to be shocked to learn, might not be super familiar with the history of Namibia, and talk a little bit about how that fits into your larger story here.
So, well, first of all, material and ideological interests are not necessarily separate spheres.
Agreed.
have ideologies and have ideological interests too. So I am not an economic historian, but I'm more interested in the politics of political economy specifically. But corporations are actively involved in decolonization, in apartheid South Africa and maintaining it, but they're on all sides, and they're often trying to, and we see that today where you'll have a company that will make donations to politicians on both sides in order, they don't, you know, whoever wins will be supportive of a particular company. That's also what mining companies did with decolonization.
Lydia, we often say on this show, corporations are people. That's kind of our motto here at American Prestige.
Corporations are people in lots of ways. They're actual literal people with friendships and connections and affinities. as well as having ideology. So that's kind of, I'm sure you've dealt with this with many other books in lots of ways, but it's something that I really get into in the Namibia chapter. So where is Namibia? Why should people care? So Namibia is in southern Africa on the Atlantic coast. It was a German colony before the First World War. The German Empire also carried out a genocide against the Herero and Nama people during the German colonial period. Sometimes this is called sort of the first German genocide. And after the First World War, the international community during this period, this is the League of Nations, this has to figure out what they're going to do with the former colonies of the German Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and also the territories of the Habsburg Empire. This is how we end up with the League of Nations mandate system. Now, these mandates are ruled by mandatory powers, but it sort of basically changes the justification for colonial rule, because now mandatory powers have to justify what they're doing about development in terms of civilizing mission. They have to create reports that are read by the League, and this becomes a portal where people who are living in the mandates can actually petition the League of Nations mandate commission about what's going on with the mandate. So Southwest Africa becomes a mandate of South Africa. And they are the lowest classification of mandate, Class C, which means that they are not going to become self-governing anytime soon. But the prospect of it is sort of baked into the mandate system. Fast forward to the end of the Second World War, and the League of Nations has become the United Nations. And the United Nations makes the mandates that are still remain UN trust territories, and they're more accelerated towards independence. So German East Africa, Tanganyika becomes a UN trust territory, becomes independent in 1961. Former German Southwest Africa remains a former League of Nations mandate administered by South Africa, because South Africa wants to annex it and the United Nations doesn't want it. Now, all that international law doesn't really matter for the people living on the ground. They are ruled by South Africa under the Southwest African Authority. They have their own version of the apartheid system that, you know, changes over time, but Black Namibians do not, don't have full representation and full rights. But what matters is that they actually have an international portal. They have their own UN committee. They have a place to go. Their advocates can be brought into the room to speak on their behalf before the nationalists are able to. Now, remember that South Africa is controlling travel to and from Namibia. So there's periods, once the dominant nationalist movement, SWAPO, once their leadership goes into exile in the early 1960s and starts petitioning the UN regularly, they haven't been in Southwest Africa, Namibia for many years. So, there becomes kind of a division between those in exile versus those who remain. This is kind of what really matters about the mandate is that it creates an international structure that is why Namibia is independent today. I mean, I did an interview with Mumburumba Karina, one of the nationalist claimants, and he relayed a conversation to me that he had had with Michael Scott when he was quite young about the importance of the mandate. And according to Karina, Scott said, the mandate doesn't matter because of Namibia becoming independent today. And by today, this is a conversation that was probably happening around 1960. the mandate mattered so that a future post-apartheid South Africa does not include Namibia. So the importance of the mandate wasn't so much, it was about maintaining that international legal border that kept Namibia separate from South Africa, even as South Africa governed Namibia. So this is a long way of talking about the importance of the mandate. That it's very important, but not in terms of people's actual daily life in Namibia under apartheid.
So how do the companies play into all of this?
So I have a map in my book that I was really happy to commission from the cartographer Jeffrey Wallace about looking at decolonization in Southern Africa. But what I wanted him to map was copper deposits layered over regime change, because it really shows how Southern Africa is kind of interconnected. And there is real discussion about, the Copper Belt, which is in predominantly in present day Zambia. But you also see how Katanga and Zambia have a shared copper reserve. So you see that kind of regional connection. You see the copper in northern Namibia. Now, there are other resources, and people are doing quite interesting work. I'd point listeners to that of Saima Ashipala on uranium in Namibia. But I focus predominantly on copper because I focus on Sumeb mine in northern Namibia, where they're not the managing company, but they're the majority shareholder. Amex Mining Company has really active interests. And in the book, I talk about Amex's decision to back SWAPO at a fairly early stage in the very early 1960s. Now, Amex had actually also really supported Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia. And so when you look at the map and you see where all the copper is, you can see where Amex has interest. So we can think about, critical geographies in all sorts of ways. Critical geopolitics in all sorts of ways. And one is international law, these mandate boundaries, which, as I said, don't make a difference for people living there. Another is where the mines are, specifically in this instance, where the copper mines are, which show that you have companies like Amex that are involved in Zambia. They're involved in northern Namibia. They're may have also been involved in Katanga, though I've had disputing accounts about that. So you can have, and there are lots of different mining companies, but they share directors. The directors are often friends with each other. They sit on each other's boards. They're not necessarily like completely separate actors from each other either.
And how do they shape the course of what's going on in this decolonizing period? Are they prime actors? I'm sure sometimes yes, sometimes no. But what would listeners need to understand about the role of companies here?
Well, I'm going to talk about Amex specifically. There are other companies that are doing other things that I haven't conducted primary research on.
For sure.
So Amex does two things that I track specifically. One is they back Kenneth Kaunda's leadership of an independent Zambia before Zambia is independent. And it's not just Amex, it's also Tanganyika Concessions and, sorry, not Tanganyika Concessions, Rhodesian Selection Trust, which Amex is a primary shareholder, but is run by Sir Ronald Prain. Prain actually becomes friends with Kaunda in part through Michael Scott. Prain introduces Kaunda to representatives of the Rockefeller Foundation. This is all before Zambia becomes independent. And this is what really kind of positions Kaunda as a leader with the backing of Western capital and Western development organizations, which are also not necessarily completely separate. Amex is a prime backer of the African-American Institute. This is now called the Africa America Institute in order to clarify its meaning. But during the time I'm talking about, it's the African American Institute. This is founded by Alan Dulles, who brings on one of the Hochschild brothers to be its director. It's about building civil society ties between new emergent nationalist elites on the African continent and the U.S. government through training programs, through scholarships, through visas. And Amex provides a certain amount of the money and leadership of the African American Institute, and it becomes a way for Amex to engage without it being Amex that it's engaging. It's a reputable NGO, the African American Institute. And this is, again, how these spheres of corporations, non-state actors, state actors are not actually separate. But again, this does not mean that the people who are doing this work are stooges. They often have very sincere convictions and are working quite hard to support anti-colonial nationalism. And Amex, part of their support of Kaunda is they see him as supportive of Western capital. Amex also desegregates their labor force in Northern Rhodesia quite early. Now, they do this because guess what? If they can pay black miners in higher level positions less than white miners. So, of course, the white miners union is not in favor of this at all. So, the interests are, there's economic reasons for desegregating the labor force in Northern Rhodesia in the 1950s. That said, they still do it. And they do it before most other corporations do it in the region. And they try to get the Southwest African Authority to support elements of desegregation in the labor force in Sumab, northern Namibia. And they do to a certain extent, though it doesn't sort of, it's not as successful as they would like. And they see this as them being progressive.
I was going to say, this is like progressive capitalism, right? And you see something very similar happening in the U.S. with civil rights, which is that capital decides to like be progressive in the early 1960s. And there's probably something to be written about that from a global perspective. Like why something happened within these mega corporations that are actually not so mega yet, but are becoming mega to be like associated with these progressive movements. Is it just profit making from your perspective? And it happened to be this is the way the winds were blowing or something more?
I think it's a combination of profit making, a combination of what I was calling this sort of liberalist ideology. I don't think you can completely separate them out. I think that, again, peaceful regime change, multiracial societies means peaceful resource extraction. A multiracial labor force may end up being that you can pay your workers less. But this doesn't mean that they aren't also
genuine. Yeah.
Genuine.
Genuine, like capitalist liberals, of which there are many.
And my book's not about this at all, but you can track this further into corporate social responsibility.
Absolutely.
And environmental work and activism and its connections to corporations. And Amex is actually one of the earliest to embrace issues of environmental activism. But for that, you might have to read Megan Black's forthcoming book.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, Lydia, this kind of leads me into a question, which is about the concept of legitimacy as dictated by outside forces. Which of these non-state groups get to be get plucked out and, you know, granted the title of legitimate versus illegitimate. And it seems like there's a very cynical story to tell here, that if you have the right politics, if you're open to letting Western mining companies come in and extract your resources, if you do, you check off all these boxes, then you get to be legitimate. It's kind of arbitrary in that sense. But I think what you're arguing is that there's some level of, like, people who think that they're operating under a set of principles. Can you sort of, as we're kind of, you know, here, you know, having covered a lot of ground in these cases, what does it suggest about how Western governments, Western corporations, you know, anybody with a stake in these movements approach this issue of who gets to be a state, or who gets to be a legitimate claimant to a state and who doesn't?
Yeah, and beyond being perceived as friendly to continued resource extraction, it's also being Christian. You know, Kenneth Kaunda is very, very good at performing a kind of sort of liberalist Christianity that gets connected to, is aligned with elements within the mainstream American civil rights movement, is aligned with these liberalist politics, part of, you know, very separate dynamics, except how I trace them through advocacy networks. But the Nagas are really, they are very, it's very important them to be publicly performing elements of Christian civilization to the outside world, the Naga nationalists, how they dress, how they present themselves, English language, you know, sort of publications and pamphlets. I mean, the Indian government hates this. And it's kind of almost juxtaposed by how Indian elites, after independence, start wearing Indian clothes in their sort of public, in their, you know, within India and outside, and how they're presenting themselves as a world leader. Think of Nehru and his sister, Vijayalakshmi Pandit. Versus before independence, I don't know if Nehru was ever photographed in Indian clothes. So this, you know, this is this kind of juxtaposition. But I mean, how is legitimacy? I mean, and I guess states in waiting is, how is legitimacy claimed before you have it? That is to a large extent what's the book's about. And there's a strong element of performance of it, but there's also working behind the scenes through these advocacy networks, through unofficial advocates. So before you can have something officially, you work towards having it unofficially. And a lot of that is public presentation, but it is also private networks, private friendships, private affinities. So it's kind of this sort of contradiction between what you can have in private versus what you can have in public. And that legitimacy in some ways is claimed privately before it can be claimed publicly. And in some ways, this is why I spend a lot of time talking about Zambia and Kenneth Kaunda, because Zambia becomes independent during this period. Kenneth Kaunda is sort of a kind of a great success of the brigade community. In fact, his ascension within the Namibian nationalist movement is why the brigade no longer needs to stay in East Africa, because he doesn't need them anymore. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly, Derek, because this isn't like a typology of, oh, you're a nationalist movement, you can do these, you know, four steps in order to become independent. But there is, it's about private networking and public performance. And to some degree, this is why, there's these two facets of sovereignty. One is the internal self-determination, and the other is the external recognition. And they both matter. But generally, people focus on one or the other, and not necessarily kind of the uneasy intersection between the two.
Thanks, Lydia. That was really comprehensive and useful. Why don't we turn now to this Friendship March, which happened in the early 60s. Is it 63? Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, 63.
Yeah, 63. And you could talk a little bit about that, and then we could get into Nagaland and how that was a very important thing.
So, as I mentioned, the Brigade community, their project in Dar es Salaam that was really about supporting Kaunda's ascension to soon to become independent Zambia sort of fizzled out when Kaunda didn't need them anymore. So their next project in the post-colonial world is a planned peace march from New Delhi to Peking, Beijing in China. And this is going to happen, this happens in 1963 for many of you might already know, but there's a war between India and China in 1962. So this is not the best time to plan to walk across the Sino-Indian border. And surprise, surprise, they never get visas to China. But they end up spending months walking across North India from New Delhi to Ledo, Assam, which is not very far from Nagaland. And the march itself is a very interesting kind of juxtaposition with the March on Washington that is happening at the same time. Baird Rustin is a member of the World Peace Brigade community. He doesn't actively work on the Delhi to Peking Friendship March because he's working on the March of Washington. And it really shows that this is part of this larger sphere of advocacy and activism. That's global. That it's, you know, in some ways an international civil rights movement. So the march, they don't get their visas, and also Michael Scott ends up having to leave the march because Scott is supportive of Nagaland and another leader of the march, Jayaprakash Narayan, and of the brigade, is a supporter of Tibet. So it's like the private kind of advocacy work of the brigade leaders ends up undermining the actual brigade project. But shortly after the march ends in like early 1964 in Ledo, Assam, so again, very close to Nagaland, the Naga Baptist Church asks Scott and J.P. Narayan to come to Nagaland and actually broker an agreement between the Naga nationalists and the Indian government. And they spend 2 years attempting to do this until 1966, when JP leaves the mission and Scott's deported. And I focus on the peace mission, and this is really kind of the culmination of the book, for several reasons. And I think this is also gets at my focus on peace politics in decolonization, when these movements are often very violent. And peace politics is not necessarily the angle most people take, is that these kinds of negotiations, this is where the records are. It's very difficult to have records of insurgent movements. But when you have a peace mission and the Indian government and Naga nationalists are presenting their information about what's actually going on in Nagaland, this is when you have documentation of atrocities. This is when you have documentation of war for these kinds of wars that people don't call war. Anyway, so 2 years of this negotiation, eventually JP's like fed up and departs, and then Scott gets deported. And this is really kind of the close that states in waiting. I might have mentioned this earlier, but Scott got his advocacy work start in 1946, working through the Indian delegation at the United Nations, speaking on behalf of Hereros of Southwest Africa. So here he is brought to the UN by not even yet independent state. India is not independent in 1946. And he's brought there to speak on behalf of a people. And the Hereros, part of the story in States in Waiting is how they kind of lose out to SWAPO in this kind of fight to see who's going to be the dominant Namibian nationalist movement. So by 66 is a totally different world from 20 years earlier. And it had been Scott's friendships with Indian politicians and political leaders that allowed his advocacy work to be possible. But 20 years later, you know, they don't want him anymore. He's, you know, this kind of politics has run its course, and it's run its course because it actually undermines post-colonial states. So nationalist movements like this kind of advocacy. They see it supporting their interests, helping them make claims in international politics, helping them access international politics. They become states in their own right. They don't want it. It undermines their sovereignty. It might empower minority nationalisms, secessionist movements, states in waiting within their own borders. So Scott's deportation from India really kind of marks the end of a narrative of advocacy and claims making that really, you know, had a huge amount of activity and seemed politically possible in the early 1960s, but by the second half of the 1960s, has really become a bit of a dead end.
And so what do you think, as we come to the end of our conversation, what do you think this particular case suggests? And then we might talk a little bit about these larger themes of about this concept of states in waiting.
I might have said this in our first session. The states in waiting is my term, but it's a term that many of my interlocutors have found resonant, that they find it kind of a useful frame for thinking about their own movements. And when people who work on other states in waiting, you know, particularly, you know, Kurds or, you know, people working on Biafra, and there's so many others, you could, it's kind of an endless category. If when they find it resonant, then that's excellent. But these histories are also quite particular. Elsewhere, I've written about Tibet and Tibetans' use of advocacy and how transnational advocacy emanating from India and the United States ends up turning the Tibetan nationalist claim into a humanitarian commodity. So that this is, you know, the relationship between advocacy and claims making is mutually transformative, and it can also be mutually undermining. So states in waiting really shows how it can be mutually undermining, where by the end, it's kind of the inherent weakness of the Naga claim that makes them reliant on advocacy for so long, while movements that become states like Zambia, they, you know, cut their ties with their former advocates when they're no longer useful. And then, of course, that no longer lack of utility then means that the advocates have to move on to other things, other projects. So, you know, but at the same time, I mean, we see there remain lots of states in waiting. They use transnational advocacy networks. They call them other things. In the political science literature, often this is referred to as rebel diplomacy. So that this actual engagement continues. And I think that it's, you know, we need to think about the relationship between the two because they're not the same thing and they don't necessarily have the same aims. But then who has the upper hand may also change over time, though generally it's the advocates, not the claimants.
And then just a final question. Obviously, decolonization is a process that is ongoing, but I think it's fair to say its major moment has passed. What is the state of this process in the 2020s? Where does it stand today? And what could we, quote unquote, learn, not in a lesson sense, but in terms of understanding the world from your research?
So I end states in waiting with indigenous claims making and how some Nagas, not all, but some, have turned to a language of global indigeneity to make claims in international politics. The UN has a 2007 declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, And in some ways, you can chart a kind of an interesting trajectory from the Declaration of Grant on the granting of independence in 1960 through the Friendly Nations Declaration that kind of really limits the kinds of peoples that can claim independence through the UN Declaration on Indigenous Peoples, which I argue really separates self-determination from sovereignty, because what it does, it says now the United Nations can recognize all these kinds of non-state self-determinations, but they're not sovereignty, and that's separate. So that's kind of a huge change from the world of the 1960s. But also that these claimants are really practical. They are going to, you know, they're going to make claims based on nationalism, human rights, humanitarianism, indigeneity, that they can get traction with in international politics. And these are claims of autonomy. These are claims of self-determination. But who is the political self in question that gets to determine that? And most importantly, for my own work as an international historian, what is the international context in which they're doing it, and how that does change over time and pretty radically, but the claims themselves often do not.
That's really a great way to end. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Everyone, please check out States in Waiting. It's an excellent book that goes all over the world in a really impressive sense. And Lydia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Danny and Derek, for having me, and an absolute pleasure to get to talk at such length. Hopefully it's of interest to others. I mean, people are like, wait, is this about Northeast India? Is this about Southern Africa? Is this about corporations? Is this about missionaries? And
yes,
it's really about how it all fits together.
And it's one of the best exemplars of international history, a truly international history I've read in a while. So thank you from my end.
Thanks a lot.
This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials, and if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E, and you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.